ideas. What you consume influences who you become. On the Mind and Matter podcast, we learn together from the best scientists and thinkers alive today about how your mind-body reacts to what you feed it. Before starting Mind and Matter, I spent 10 years in academia doing scientific research. I got a PhD in neuroscience, where I focused on neuroendocrinology and the neurobiology of behavior. And before that, I specialized in molecular, developmental, and evolutionary genetics. I use my scientific background to help parse and translate the information that guests share on the podcast. In addition to the podcast, I write long-form written content inspired by the show where I integrate what I've learned across episodes. I also have a free weekly newsletter where I provide you with upcoming guests, share links, and provide commentary on scientific studies and research that I'm reading, and more. Visit mindandmatter.substack.com to find all of my content. This episode is ad-free, and I rely on my audience to support my efforts. If you're getting value from this content, please consider becoming a paid subscriber to the Mind and Matter Substack. For just $5 a month, you'll get early access to episodes and other content, full episode transcripts, and I'll prioritize answering your questions in emails and the comments sections. You can also support me by checking out the links in the episode description to my affiliate partners, who make various health and wellness products that I use and enjoy myself. You'll receive a discount and help support the podcast that way. And if you want the benefits of a paid subscription, but it's not in your budget, simply sign up for my free weekly newsletter, send me an email, and I'll give you a complimentary paid subscription. Word of mouth is the best way to help the podcast grow. So if you like what I'm doing, please share your favorite episodes with family and friends. The purpose of the podcast is to provide you with information obtained largely from primary sources, the people doing the research and producing new knowledge. This content is never meant to serve as medical advice. And with that, enjoy the episode.
Sure. I am a professor at University of South Florida, Morsani College of Medicine. I did my undergraduate in nutrition science and biology, and then I studied neuroscience and physiology with a focus on the neural control of autonomic regulation for my PhD, specifically in the context of the hypoxic response or response to hypoxia. And then as a postdoctoral fellow, I studied extreme environments. And then I have a more general kind of education background as a professor. I teach neuropharmacology. I teach nutrition. I teach physiology. And I teach medical students, PhD students, master's students, and honors undergrad students. And I do about 50% teaching, 50% research. Run a research lab and do teaching.
What are you working on in the lab these days? What's the focus?
Yeah, we have a lot of different projects. I should mention also cancer research we do. The last conference I came from was on an inborn error metabolism called glycogen storage disease type 2, which is also called POMP disease. There's a number of these inborn errors of metabolism that these disease processes are highly receptive to ketogenic interventions that change metabolic physiology, brain energy metabolism. We've studied glucose transporter type 1 deficiency syndrome, Kabuki syndrome, which is a genetic disorder where the ketone bodies act as epigenetic regulators on gene expression. I've studied POMP disease, Angelman syndrome. I guess what you could say what has paid the bills in the lab and allowed me to expand into different applications is Navy funding to develop ketogenic strategies to enhance warfighter resilience in extreme environments. So that would be like high oxygen environment associated in a high hyperbaric pressure environments. I've worked in the capacity of looking at nanoscopic changes with atomic force microscopes to laser confocal to mice studies, rat studies, collaborative pig studies, human studies, where I've been a subject living in a hyperbaric environment underwater for 10 days, where I'm the subject and I do research on astronauts because they train in these extreme environments in isolated extreme environments for their preparation for the space station. So that would be NASA's Extreme Environment Mission Operations, or NEMO 22. And my wife was on NEMO 23. So we've studied everything from the mitochondria to like the whole human and everything in between as far as extreme environments.
When you're in that hyperbaric environment, what's it like? What happens? What are some of the adaptations of the human body when someone goes into those conditions?
Yeah, you know, it's, you know, the human body is incredibly adaptable. I teach nutrition, so it's amazing that like we can adapt to so many different nutritional things, to eating just 100% plants to 100% meat. And it is remarkable how adaptive we are. I was going to say at least in the short term, but in the relatively long term, to changes in the composition of gases and pressure. So I was in the Aquarius habitat, which is off of the Keys in Isla Mirada, about 5-6 miles off. And it's a submerged habitat that's down to about almost 3 atmospheres of pressure. So unlike a submarine, which stays at 1 atmosphere of pressure, the submerged habitat for training is about 3 atmospheres of pressure. And then you can go outside of that and do work. And that's called like an EVA, or extra vehicular activity. If you're on the space station and you go outside the space station to work on it, that's called an EVA. So you get like suited up to do EVAs, to do different work things. So we measured, some of it's published, some of it's not, but we, for example, we wear like the Oura ring. So we look at sleep, look at HRV. We wear the polar V800, so we get a little bit higher HRV. We look at the microbiome, how the microbiome changes in extreme, like skin microbiome, the microbiome of the underwater habitat, which is kind of interesting. We look at blood. We do blood samples of like hormones, hsCRP, different things like that. My wife's a behavioral neuroscientist, so we look at stress. So we look at stress hormones like cortisol, but also look at like the impact of how allostatic load impacts like different stress. So we use like NIH toolbox. We look at depression, anxiety, you know, GAD-7, PHQ-9. We look at sleep. We'll actually take like, what's it called? An iPad that's suited for underwater applications, an iDive, I think they call it. So we take the iPads outside of the dry habitat, which is under pressure, in the wet habitat, when we're all suited up to do the EVAs, and we'll look at like reaction time and how, you know, this amount of pressure is impacting reaction time, decision-making, a whole host of different things. We look at taste receptors, you know, it's because, you know, taste receptors can change under hyperbaric pressure. And of course, NASA has all their things. So actually, it's to vet out different procedures, different tools. For example, like we test a drill underwater. We go out and collect different corals like Siderastria and different like corals that may be endangered. And we bring them back, and we have a mini DNA analyzer and sequencer where we look at like, you know, the actual species. And then we actually go back and plant the corals in like a coral nursery to propagate certain species. So they like put us to work under there. But there's a whole host. That's just like a little sample of objectives that we have. I'm more of like the biomedical guy, but then we have like engineers and, you know, environmental biologists and stuff working with us. In addition to some of the top NASA astronauts, actually Buzz Aldrin, like signed right above my bunk that I was sleeping in. So we've had some like, you know, pretty big astronauts on those missions. So it was really an amazing experience, you know, to work in that environment.
And so it sounds like there's a tie-in here for ketosis and the ketogenic diet. So when, can you give people just a very brief overview of what ketosis is and how you start to think about why changing your metabolic state like that would tie into, you know, making you more resilient in certain environments?
Yeah, it's kind of a little bit counterintuitive, but I guess I'll start from the context of fasting. And we've known from millennia that when our body's in a fasted state, that can actually control seizures. We've known this for quite some time, but we didn't know the mechanism for how it does that. right? So, you know, in the 1920s, the ketogenic diet was developed as a therapy for seizures, independent of the etiology of the seizure. Being in a state of ketosis provided an anti-seizure effect. And a ketogenic diet is one that has a macronutrient ratio that is primarily fat and has an adequate amount of protein to prevent protein malnutrition. So just enough, but not too much. It's kind of somewhat protein deficient, actually, and essentially zero carbohydrates or maybe some indigestible fiber, you know, soluble and maybe insoluble fibers added to more like engineered ketogenic diet nowadays. So when we eat that, that has little or no impact on the hormone insulin relative to the fasting state. So it stimulates fatty acid oxidation in the muscles and in the liver, and beta oxidation of fatty acids in the liver contributes to the generation of ketone bodies, which the liver generates ketones, but does not use the ketones as a fuel source. So they spill into circulation, and they, after a period of time of on the ketogenic diet or fasting, the ketones become the primary energy source for the brain in a fasted state and on a strict ketogenic diet. Our blood glucose surprisingly doesn't change much because the homeostatic mechanisms that maintain blood glucose are very robust, I guess you would say. So we have things like the glycerol backbone of triglycerides becomes glucose. Gluconeogenic amino acids from skeletal muscle can become glucose. But the ketone bodies largely replace the need for glucose. So they become very glucose sparing, and they also have a profound anti-catabolic effect. So they prevent the catabolism of skeletal muscle to liberate that gluconeogenic amino acid. So it decreases that need for that. And evolutionarily speaking, the being in a state of ketosis, one could think about like the ketone bodies, they play a big role in allowing humans to stay in a fasted state for a protracted period of time without wasting away. So I guess Dr. George Cahill did a lot of the early starvation studies, and you know, I was really into his research, and he was from Harvard Medical School. He did a number of interesting fasting studies where he fasted subjects for 40 days. back then, you could get it approved by the IRB in the 60s. So, and saw some remarkable changes in brain energy metabolism and the fuel use by the brain. So, but when you're in a state of ketosis, then those ketones kind of have, you know, the body is set up to protect skeletal muscle in a state of ketosis. So I think, and this comes up quite often, the protein requirements needed on a ketogenic diet may be less because of the anti-catabolic effects of ketone bodies.
So when you're in ketosis, there's this anti-catabolic effect, meaning that you will lose muscle mass more slowly than you otherwise would.
Yeah, I think that's a correct statement in the context of fasting. And in the context of a ketogenic diet, you could titrate the protein in to prevent any muscle loss. And then you could adjust the protein higher to build muscle and build protein. And that level of protein that's needed, it's still not clear, and I think it's age dependent. You know, young, healthy relative to older people, maybe less because ketones are anti-catabolic. But I'm of the opinion that if you improve metabolic health biomarkers, lower inflammation, you kind of reverse anabolic resistance in a way that you make your body more sensitive to the protein that you have. So, you know, no one really like thinks in these terms, but I just coming from like the fitness, you could just see like even myself, for example, I could maintain and even build protein if I improve my metabolic health, you know, and it's like, and I think there's a lot to unpack there, but I think the point is that like, if we improve our metabolic health biomarkers, I think we could, especially as we get older and you have insulin resistant subjects that are anabolic resistant, if they improve their metabolic health biomarkers and lower inflammation, they are more, they can be more anabolic to the, a given amount of protein. That makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, that makes intuitive sense to me, because if you imagine two people and one of them has just a higher baseline level of inflammation, they just suffer from chronic inflammation, that inflammation is coming from immune system activity, and that's going to require some amino acids to power it. So like, you know, the amino acids you're consuming in your diet are going to some extent get shuttled towards those things. So the extent to which you reduce whole body inflammation, the more that's left over for other things.
Yeah. Insulin's working better. Of course, you know, inflammatory, like, you know, TNF-alpha, I think it used to be called cachexin, right? Because it was associated with muscle wasting. Like many of these inflammatory cytokines and chemokines are catabolic. And if you keep them at a lower baseline level, then you favorably change the protein anabolism and anti-catabolic state too, I think.
Why does a traditional ketogenic diet involve adequate protein, relatively low protein intake rather than higher intake? Or to say it a slightly different way, what would be the difference in terms of the general metabolic response of a person if they were on the classic strict ketogenic diet? So little to no carbs, relatively high fat intake and some protein intake, versus someone who was on the exact same ketogenic diet, but they had higher protein intake.
Yeah, it kind of varies between people too. So I guess broadly speaking, as we titrate in more protein from like say 7 or 8%, which was kind of used in pediatric epilepsy, upwards of 20 to 30%, we're going to see a proportional decrease in ketone production, largely because the protein stimulates insulin, not as much as carbohydrates, maybe about a third as much, but a small increase in insulin is enough to decrease ketogenesis, beta oxidation, just by elevating insulin a little bit.
I see. So because protein does affect insulin to some extent, basically the protein content of your diet on a ketogenic diet or in a state of ketosis is going to affect the depth of ketosis in terms of how many ketone bodies are being produced.
Yeah. And I think ketosis is inversely proportional to insulin, and insulin suppression is needed to sustain and maintain ketogenesis. So like if you're in a state of ketosis, like the, you know, the famous Cahill study where they inject insulin, 20 IUs of insulin in fasted subjects, it caused dramatic glucose uptake, or glucose disposal, to where the blood levels of glucose went down to like 1 millimolar, but the subjects were asymptomatic for hypoglycemia. This is a fatal dose of insulin, but because they were fasted and their ketones were elevated, they didn't die. So if you just go into the general population and inject, you know, and have them fast for, you know, 6 hours, and inject them in 20 IUs of insulin, everybody would die. But these subjects were fasted. It was a very bold, very bold experiment. And there was an extension of that experiment. It didn't make it into the peer reviewed publication, but I found it in a book where they injected the insulin. So they did the 40 day fasting, and that got published. And then it was like, you know, I found some figures in another book where they injected the insulin. and then I later talked to some of the investigators before they had passed away a few years ago. But, you know, they were asymptomatic for hypoglycemia. So it was a very dramatic demonstration that the brain has a metabolic flexibility to adapt acutely from using a glucose to using ketone bodies. I mean, they had been adapted over time, but we have the capacity to use ketones at any time. So we could administer exogenous ketones and then theoretically lower blood glucose and be protected. Mm-hmm. And that became extremely interesting and exciting to me because nobody knew about that. And that actually changed the direction of my career to like study different strategies for ketosis.
So when you're in a state of ketosis, you're using ketone bodies for energy, and there's this anti-catabolic effect. So there's this protein sparing effect that comes with being in that state. If you're in if you're in a state of perfect energy balance, so you're getting just the amount of calories you need on a ketogenic diet, is your body going to nonetheless burn off body fat as a source of ketones?
You will stay in energy. If you're in energy balance, I think that's a question. You will have much greater flux of fat going into adipose and fat coming out of adipose. So the fat flux, if you will, and the fatty acid oxidation and ketogenesis will be ramped up, as will fatty acid oxidation enzymes, ketone transporters like the MCT transporter, ketolytic enzymes. All these things will be greatly augmented and enhanced. But if you are in energy balance, and many people would may argue this with me, I don't think that your fat levels will change unless you are like very insulin resistant and obese and type 2 diabetes, and then you go on a ketogenic diet, maintain energy balance, and you tend to decrease inflammation and various cardiometabolic biomarkers that may favor body composition changes that could result in accruing more lean body mass relative to fat mass. So you may be, you know, have a body composition effect just by virtue of improving certain hormones too, like testosterone could go up, you know, especially in like obese. So I've seen this before where almost like, yeah, but like a weight stable person and mm-hmm. their body composition changes, especially if they're doing resistance training.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So if you are an otherwise metabolically healthy person and you go into ketosis via a ketogenic diet, you probably won't lose body fat if you're in energy balance. But if you go into negative energy balance and you deprive yourself because you're in flux so much more and there's just more sort of turnover and metabolism of the fats in general, it sounds like you probably would see an accelerated body fat loss.
I think so. I think it would be maybe subtle compared to like, you know, a low carb diet or even, you know, I think that's favorable. I think, and it all depends of course on the protein concentration too, right? Like, I think where you're getting at, I think the early practitioners of low carb diets, and I think maybe some today, feel that there's a metabolic advantage to being in a state of ketosis that favors more favorable body composition alterations, you know, just by virtue of being in a state of ketosis. And I believe that there's some truth to that, especially if you take someone who is insulin resistant. But I also, for the average person, I think it's kind of negligible, like, you know, and the body composition changes will more reflect, like, you know, if you standardize for protein and calories and all things are equal and you switch out carbohydrates to fat, I think it's pretty much the same. But I do think, you know, there may be some truth to a metabolic advantage of a ketogenic diet. I mean, you could, you know, when you're urinating out ketones, it's ketone urea. And at the end of the day, that's about 150 calories of someone in ketosis. So there's like that, there's like, you know, various uncoupling proteins that may be upregulated and maybe, but I think there's a lot of debate about this and a lot of discussion, but I think it's kind of like in the weeds, you know?
I want to talk a little bit about the time duration dependent effects of ketosis. So, you know, if someone starts a ketogenic diet, they go into ketosis. If they do that for like a couple days, let's say someone cycles in and out of ketosis on a weekly basis, you know, for a couple days, versus someone who's in a ketogenic, on a ketogenic diet for an extended period of time, weeks and weeks, are there going to be any differences beyond just the time component here? Meaning, you know, if I stay in ketosis day after day after day, are there metabolic adaptations and things that settle in after many days or even weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, there's epigenetic changes too, right? Because as we change, metabolites are epigenetic signaling molecules, lactate, even beta-hydroxybutyrate. The longer you're in ketosis, the more you're changing mitochondrial function, mitochondrial biogenesis, by altering PPAR alpha and gamma and a number of different fatty acid oxidation enzymes are increasing. And essentially what you're doing initially, once you start a ketogenic diet, there's an increase in reactive oxygen species. So, and that can increase things like NRF2 and various antioxidant enzymes, because you're forcing the mitochondria to work harder. You're decreasing glycolysis, and it's a stress to the mitochondria to make energy to meet the bioenergetic needs of the cell to make the ATP. So there's just like initial stress, and maybe that symptomatically people feel that in regard to the keto flu, but I think maybe some other things are going on. But yeah, the longer you kind of maintain this dramatically altered physiological state, the more pressure you're putting on the mitochondria to force adaptations, which include mitochondrial biogenesis and also mitochondrial efficiency over time. So I think you're increasing the mitochondrial capacity to make ATP independent of relying on glycolysis. And I think that has a lot of functional advantages in regard to metabolic flexibility. You're more able to fast, you're more able to be more resilient under periods of limited carbohydrate availability or even food availability. Like, I found this out to be, anecdotally, like, you feel that, and then the animal data shows that, and I would say not a whole lot of human data has studied this, but I think it's a real phenomenon. That's keto adaptation. Keto adaptation gets thrown around a lot. And I think we don't, not a lot of people have studied it. And I think but I think people, athletes, all, kind of transition in and out of ketosis, especially like endurance athletes. So they're in some ways kind of keto adapted to begin with. They can transition in and out of ketosis, but the average sedentary person can't. So thrusting them into ketosis with fasting or a ketogenic diet can produce some pretty profound alterations, I think, in mitochondrial stress and mitochondrial adaptations.
Yeah. So the state of metabolic health that you have to start with, the amount of time that you exercise and the frequency and intensity of things like exercise and fasting probably changes your ability to easily switch into and out of these different metabolic states without having unwanted side effects.
Yeah. And I think the big driver is insulin in all this. So just being able to function while you're suppressing the hormone insulin and decreasing glycolysis, that may decrease brain energy metabolism, because the brain is now, looking for energy. The liver may be sluggish in making ketones, because you have to overcome some of the insulin resistance to really drive high levels of ketogenesis. And that's too, like, that's where exogenous ketones can come in too, or even medium chain triglycerides, ketogenic fats can be helpful there for that initial transition.
I see. So basically supplementing the body with those things through diet while the body's endogenous mechanisms ramp up ketone production.
Yeah. And I think we've done a lot of work with ketone esters, and I think large doses of ketone esters may reduce or suppress some of that, those adaptations if they're consumed in large quantities. What I've found just through testing, that if you consume exogenous ketones where it quickly elevates your ketones, where you have a delta of like 2 millimolar, that will elicit an insulin response. And that could decrease your own endogenous ketone production. Whereas if you take like smaller doses of like a ketone electrolyte salt, I use KetoStart, which is like electrolytes bound to beta hydroxybutyrate, and then consume it and just bump yourself up like 1 millimolar, maybe 2 or 3 times a day. That has no effect on insulin, but at the same time, is actually the presence of ketones in tissues tends to upregulate the transporters and the ketolytic enzyme. So you can actually enhance your keto adaptation by exogenously elevating your ketones over time, as long as you don't increase insulin, which tends to decrease your fat oxidation in the liver. So, and you could do that with MCT too, but, or ideally the combination of MCT with like a ketone electrolyte But large doses of ketone esters can like spike your ketones up and then your ketones come down. And because you release insulin and when your ketones come down, you're hypoketotic and hypoglycemic. So for me, I get a headache and that can like tank performance. So I've, you know, talked to athletes that are not aware of this and then it can crush their performance. So I think, I guess the important message is that higher is not better when it comes to, I was of the opinion that it was when I got into this research and for certain applications, it is like, you want to get up into like the 3 to 4 millimolar range.
But. I see. So sort of a certain amount of exogenous ketone ingestion can help your body adapt faster. But if you go higher than that amount, you can get an insulin response and then the outcome will be very different.
Yeah, because there's a lot of counter-regulatory mechanisms when you spike your ketone levels up. You know, you're elevating insulin and a whole host of counter-regulatory mechanisms that can kind of throw your body off and you just don't feel well. So I think for certain therapeutic applications, I think we might need to get up into the higher ranges. But for people looking just to enhance their metabolic health, performance, and for me, I just mostly use it for mental energy, clarity, you know, keeping energy levels high when glucose and insulin are low. You can kind of hack that system, if you want to use that term, with exogenous ketones. And I think they become an important tool for that. And, you know, we study different disease models and definitely see some pretty profound, you know, therapeutic applications of these molecules, mostly from the neuroscience, resilience, but also from the anti-inflammatory effects, looking at epigenetic effects. And then we also study cancer. We see some interesting anti-cancer effects of ketones too.
Given how widespread diabetes is, how widespread insulin resistance is, and everything that you just told us, are there any dangers for someone who has, say, type 2 diabetes and is strongly insulin resistant? Are there any dangers or things that they should be aware of if they were going to, say, try a ketogenic diet?
Well, I'm a strong advocate for doing blood work. I do it quarterly, maybe a little bit over the top, but I think it's important to get like your basic comprehensive metabolic panel, CBC, CMP, blood pressure. So actually, of all the different diets, you know, I've kind of took a deep dive on blood pressure. Low carb diets and ketogenic diets have a much greater blood pressure lowering effect than, for example, like a calorie restricted high carb diet. So that actually could mean, and I've had people email me about this, if someone doesn't change their blood pressure medication and they go on a ketogenic diet, they can have, you know, get dizzy. They could be low blood pressure. Orthostatic hypotension is very common.
Okay, so if they're on meds that lower blood pressure and they go on a ketogenic diet, that also lowers blood pressure, so you can lower it too much.
Yeah. And I also think that some medications, especially like lipophilic compounds, tend to get more permeability to the blood-brain barrier when you're on a ketogenic diet. So this is something that no one has studied, but just from investigators that look at like brain levels of certain drugs, like it's up pretty profoundly, I think. And anecdotally, when I experiment with, you know, different compounds and stuff, things that are more lipophilic, I'm in a deep state of ketosis. It's just much, much stronger. So I know it's either, you know, penetrating the blood-brain barrier or enhancing receptor function. Something's going on there that's pretty profound. Years ago, I got invited to UBC Pharmaceuticals in Belgium. They're the drug Keppra. And Keppra, you know, the idea behind using the ketogenic diet for epilepsy is to replace drugs, but there's also an observation that certain anti-epileptic drugs are enhanced by the ketogenic diet. So you could use like a very small dose and get effects. And I think that's a really interesting area of research that we're not really doing, but I think should be funded. So the enhancement of, you know, different drugs, I guess using diet to enhance different drug therapies.
Yeah. So I guess the basic idea is in certain metabolic states like ketosis, it might be that certain drugs, which are fat soluble, are actually more potent effectively because they're getting into the brain more efficiently, or something else has changed.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot going on there. And it's like people acknowledge it and recognize it, but there's not a whole lot of like direct studies on that. And I think that that's important. There's a lot of interest in getting things across the blood-brain barrier, like with enzyme replacement therapy, for example, for glycogen storage diseases. I'm of the opinion that, you know, there's certain ways to do that. Dietarily, some of these compounds work better in like an acidic environment. You could use like IV ascorbic acid and things like that. So I think there's a lot of potential to look at diet drug interactions. And I used to teach that subjects at the medical school. And also another important thing is the effect of different drugs on nutritional status, which is something I also teach, like, you know, proton pump inhibitors on vitamin B12, you know, things like that. So I think people should appreciate some of these things.
Given the impact ketosis has on insulin and blood glucose levels, is this, how widely is the ketogenic diet accepted as a potential treatment avenue for things like diabetes, as a tool to help stabilize blood glucose and decrease insulin resistance?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of studies being done now. Virta Health has spearheaded many studies using low carb diets and ketogenic diet for the metabolic management of type 2 diabetes, you know, and obesity in some patients. And I think if you were to go on like clinicaltrials.gov now, you go 10 years ago, there might have been one study. Now, I think there's over a dozen registered clinical trials on the use of ketogenic therapies for type 2 diabetes. You'll find trials on Alzheimer's, you know, muscle wasting, weight loss. So the science is definitely emerging. And I think now we can, it's generally accepted that of the evidence-based applications, I think there's about a dozen or more for ketogenic diet. Under that would be type 2 diabetes, for sure. And an emerging application is actually type 1 diabetes, which is kind of interesting, right? Because you have diabetic ketoacidosis. Dr. Belinda Lennertz at Harvard has been studying low-carb diets and ketogenic diets for type 1 diabetes. Kind of makes sense because whenever you could use less insulin to manage type 1 diabetes, an endocrinologist would have to agree that that's a good thing, right? And if you look at a type 1 diabetic patient's CGM, a week of CGM data before and after transitioning from a standard American Diabetes Association high carb diet to a ketogenic diet, it's like night and day. Mm-hmm. And typically insulin requirements go down 50 to 80%. Mm-hmm. So, and that has to be a good thing. Although there's a little bit of pushback, you know, from some people about lipid changes on a ketogenic diet, in particular LDL and ApoB. And there's some research on that that's kind of ongoing. And I think that's an interesting area of research that deserves more attention. And there's even a phenotype called the lean mass hyperresponder, where you have very low triglycerides, very high HDL above 80, and you have astronomically elevated LDL and ApoB in some cases. You know, I think the cutoff point is like 200 ApoB, but I've seen, you know, 500 LDL, 600 LDL.
And I guess what's interesting about this, or potentially confusing about this, and sort of the what's implicit in everything I think we're about to say is we don't know the answers to all of these things.
Yeah.
But traditionally, a traditionally trained physician would consider, oh, HDL high is good, triglycerides low is good, LDL high is bad. But in these particular people, you've got low triglycerides, which is good. You've got high triglycerides or high HDL, which would be considered fine. But then they also have very high LDL, which you would normally think of as a bad thing, but it doesn't seem to be in these people. Is that kind of what it looks like?
Yeah. And well, you know, blood pressure, glycemia, you know, triglycerides, you know, all these things are improving. But the elevation of LDL and ApoB, which is causative for ASCVD, is is high in many. And I thought, you know, this was kind of a rare anomaly when we started doing this research and noticed that people that sustained a ketogenic diet that had more of an athletic phenotype, that were lean, hence the name lean mass hyperresponder, tend to present with this elevated LDL and ApoB. So it ties into a hypothesis or a theory called the lipid energy model. And I think it was posited or advanced by Dr. David Ludwig from Harvard, that the lipoproteins are functioning in lipid transport and lipid trafficking. So the idea is that, you know, if peripheral tissues are using astronomically more fatty acids for fuel, so we need a lipid transport system, right? Because fats need to be on a lipoprotein to be transported. So you need more, a greater carrying capacity for lipid trafficking to have these greatly augmented fatty acid oxidation, which is observed at the level of skeletal muscle, the heart, and peripheral tissues. So the fat needs to get there by some mechanism, and I'm simplifying it, and there's a lot of, you know,
but the idea is if you're using primarily fat for energy, and you're lean, meaning you're exercising a lot, your energy demands are high, you need a transporter like LDL to actually get it through the body and to where it needs to go.
Yep. And I will actually say that I just want to quickly say that I've never seen someone that's very low carb or ketogenic that's an advanced athlete with low LDL. Like, I've never ever seen that. So I think it ties into supporting that hypothesis.
Okay. And so that was kind of going to be related to my next question, which is this phenotype, how general is it? It sounds like most people, if they're lean and athletic and in eating a ketogenic diet, say, they're probably going to have this general phenotype, or is it a subset of people with a certain genotype? In other words, certain lean athletic people won't display this pattern.
Yeah, good question. I think we need more data, but I have communicated with so many people, like hundreds. And like I said, I've never seen someone who's lean, have a low BMI, who has high level of athletic capacity and performance, that's strictly low carb or ketogenic, that has even like a normal LDL. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost always elevated. However, if you take someone with type 2 diabetes, obesity, metabolic syndrome, and their LDL at baseline is high, and you put them on a low carb ketogenic diet, LDL typically comes down. We see that, you know, with subjects who have a high BMI and you put them on low carb or ketogenic, that biomarker and all the other biomarkers go in the right direction. Mm-hmm. But it's almost like you need like a trained subject who has a very high fat oxidation capacity. And this lends itself, you know, I was a little skeptical when this theory kind of got thrown out there, but the more data I see, the more I see the data supporting case reports, case series, and even RCTs supporting this idea of lipid energy model.
At the very least, this would seem to say to me that, you know, the direction that things move, so the direction that LDL goes, does it go up, does it go down, your overall state of metabolic health, whether these things are good or bad, is highly context dependent. It depends on the individual and where they're starting in terms of their overall metabolic health. In other words, we can't just say LDL up is always bad for everyone. That's probably not viable.
Yeah. And if LDL is up and ApoB is up in someone who has a genetic predisposition for cardiovascular disease, I would be concerned about that. I guess the question we really need to ask, if all other things are equal, right? And if someone has beautiful, you know, cardiometabolic biomarkers, and one person has an LDL of 350 and an ApoB of 160, where you have another subject who has a third level of, you know, an LDL of 100 and ApoB of 50 or whatever, all things considered, is the person, you know, with the lower LDL and ApoB at a significantly reduced atherogenic risk? Those studies are ongoing, and I think they're important. They're important for the field of, like, for epilepsy, type 2 diabetes, Alzheimer's, because even the conference that I came back at, which is a rare inborn error metabolism, some of the physicians and clinicians are, they're very hesitant to put even kids on a ketogenic diet because of the potential elevation of LDL. I'll say that if triglycerides start to go up on a ketogenic diet, that's a bad sign. That's, you know, the body's not adapting to burning fat for fuel, but usually it comes down after a period of time.
Interesting. So I want to ask one more question about LDL. So in general, the sort of standard traditional thinking would be higher LDL is bad, lower LDL is good. But, you know, we've got all of these weird patterns related to the lean mass hyperresponders and other things that might make us conclude that's at least a little too simplistic. Another pattern I've seen that I would love to get your take on is just the relationship between total LDL levels and all-cause mortality. Because in my reading of the literature, the all-cause mortality risk goes up if your LDL goes too high, but it also goes up if it goes too low. So there's this nonlinear relationship. Is that your understanding, and what do you make of that?
Well, it's very context dependent. So in very low LDL is a sign of other disease processes. So I've looked at enough blood work from cancer patients, for example, where their LDL tanks, and presumably the expanding tumor mass of a patient is contingent upon sucking up LDL and using for fuel. And also, you know, I don't know if that excludes people on lipid lowering medication too, right? So if they push it way down with a statin, then they probably have some comorbidities and things associated with it. And then there's a lot of discussion too about, you know, people with higher LDL decreasing all-cause mortality up to a certain point. And I think that's what you mentioned, right? So that these people, that may just be a function of people that are normal, healthy, maybe higher LDL may indicate that they have a more nutritious background, that they're getting better protein sources, that, you know, that they're living longer, because it just could be like a healthy user bias, you know, that their LDL is high and they're living longer just because they're healthy and they're eating. But I think the LDL thing gets a lot of wind, and I think there's other biomarkers, but we do have drugs to lower it. And I think for some people, definitely if you have a predisposition for cardiovascular disease, I think it's important to adjust your diet or do a pharmaceutical intervention. I actually did an experiment with ezetimibe, and I did a genetic test with GB Health Watch, which indicated that I had a missense mutation in the MPC1L1 transporter, which is in the gut, and that transports cholesterol. Presumably, I have a gain of function increase in the ability of that transporter, or maybe more transporters, to hyperabsorb cholesterol. So, which I took I'm microdosing ezetimibe, and it cut
what
my
is
LDL.
Ezetimibe?
Ezetimibe is an inhibitor of the Niemann-Pick C1 like one receptor, or MPC1L1 receptor, and it's a specific cholesterol transporter in the intestines. So it plays a role in cholesterol absorption, and people have different levels of this, and there's, like, you know, the Niemann, there's MPC2, and there's Niemann-Pick's disease, right? So that's like excess, you know, lipid in the brain, and there's, you know, various diseases associated with different versions of this transporter. But this particular transporter is in the gut. It's also in the liver. So that brings up the question, when you take Zetia or ezetimibe, is it impacting sort of liver cholesterol processing? But what I can say is that a very small dose of ezetimibe as a standalone, not together with a statin, dramatically lowered my ApoB and LDL. The lipid energy model may posit that this would decrease performance, because that could potentially decrease lipid trafficking. So I think an interesting question would be to take some of the lean mass hyperresponders that are high performance athletes and cut their ApoB LDL by 60 to 80%.
And then measure their performance.
Time to exhaustion, metabolic cart, performance measures, a whole host to see. I think that would be a valid test. I've discussed this on other podcasts, and I think that's experiments to be done. A good way to test that. But I personally did not see. I cut my ApoB in half, and you would think you would feel something if I go from cholesterol of 270 to like 105, right? And my ApoB from 165 to 80. I had an increase in performance and strength in some things. And I didn't alter my diet at all. I just took a very low dose of a drug that has very little, if any, side effects relative to like something like a statin. Mm-hmm. So this could be a pharmaceutical intervention that I may stick with, but I've transitioned off of it and I've added some different forms of fiber and also adjusting my diet a little bit to see if I can maintain those numbers independent of drug therapy. So, which is kind of like my ultimate goal. Mm-hmm.
Is that something that's like a guiding principle for you in your life to try and minimize drug use unless you find it to be absolutely necessary?
For some drugs. So what I also observed is with the ezetimibe is that my liver enzymes went from the 20s to the upper 40s. Mm. And I do a lot of blood work, so I pretty much know my body. And there's a couple papers of like, liver stress, I think a case report of someone with liver failure. So I could have some weird SNP or genetic anomaly that makes me the inhibition of the MPC1 L1 is somehow causing liver stress. And because I'm taking a really low dose, and to see that, but at the same time, I'm eating a lot of protein. I train pretty heavy, about 3 times a week. So that could be some, I'm reproducing it. So I've transitioned off the low dose of ezetimibe, and I'm going to do 2 months just with a psyllium fiber and incorporating more nuts and decreasing my dietary cholesterol consumption, which is like 3 to 5,000 milligrams per day when I did like my, when I calculated it, which is pretty high. Even Paleolithic man had something like 500 milligrams a day. So it's like, you can't argue that like, it's kind of unnatural because I eat a ton of eggs and like, sometimes 2 or 3 pounds of beef. So like my total cholesterol consumption is kind of high. So I'm thinking more about longevity as I approach 50, just about 50. So getting all my cardiometabolic biomarkers in the optimal range is like my goal now. Like it used to be like performance and strength goals, but now the numbers that I focus on are my biomarkers for longevity.
And so given the comment you just made about your cholesterol intake, so you eat a lot of eggs and things like this.
Yeah.
What is the relationship between dietary cholesterol and blood cholesterol levels in general? / if you eat a lot of dietary cholesterol, what are the main things in the body that's going to drive?
Yeah. So for most people, unless you have like a mutation in the MPC1 L1 receptor, are not hyperabsorbers. So taking a drug like Zetia or ezetimibe, at least if you look at the studies as a standalone, may drop LDL like 10%. So typically what they do is add it to a statin. But the more I talk to people, there must be a lot of people that are hyperabsorbers, because I feel like maybe the pharmaceutical industry added Zetia to some of these statin drugs to make them look better. Just because I talked to so many people who took Zetia or ezetimibe, and they had a profound decrease in their LDL and their ApoB. Not everybody, but quite a few people, more than you would expect based on the literature. So, but generally speaking, and everyone's a bit different, that dietary cholesterol, so things like eggs have other components in it that can maybe enhance cholesterol and excretion of cholesterol through bile acids and things like that. So generally speaking, dietary cholesterol plays a minimal role in LDL and ApoB if you go to the literature. But in some people, for me, example, I think as an example, I think it plays a pretty profound role in ApoB and LDL.
Going back to the subject of ketosis and the ketogenic diet with respect to insulin resistance and diabetes, what is your general take on the dietary recommendations we get from official institutions, big institutions like the American Diabetes Association? They generally don't seem to recommend things like the ketogenic diet. They recommend other diets. I'm not sure. How would you characterize the recommendations and what do you make of them?
Yeah. Well, I'm actually interviewing Nina Teicholz on this later today. The recommendations are definitely biased towards a carbohydrate-centric diet. I grew up farming, you get subsidies for growing certain crops and wheat and things like that. So I think for political reasons and maybe some historical reasons for scientists like Ansel Keys and everything demonizing saturated fat, animal protein, I think there's a bias there. But I think the big problem is processed food, hyperpalatable food. But I do think simple, it doesn't have to be ketogenic and it doesn't have to be very low carb, but simply titrating the amount of carbohydrates into the individual. And how do we do that? We do that through one way to do it. It might sound a little bit over the top, but for normal, healthy people to wear a continuous glucose monitor, mm-hmm. or someone who just has some weight to lose, because if we're spiking glucose and having big postprandial excursions in glucose, we're simultaneously releasing insulin at levels that we should not be doing, like that are almost super physiological. And those repeated spikes in glucose and insulin are going to have big consequences on our metabolic health over time. And I think everyone pretty much agrees with that. Well, the literature for type 2 diabetes strongly agrees that glucose and insulin spikes profoundly impact metabolic health, but it just has not been studied in non-diabetics because non-diabetics don't wear CGMs. Mm-hmm. But I think, I'm an advocate of at least, for people who want to improve their metabolic health, especially people who have type 2 diabetes in the family, to slap on a CGM, have their doctors prescribe it, and then actually eat their normal diet and to see what's going on. And if they're getting postprandial excursions in the 200 and 300s, which many people are by eating the standard American diet, then they have to think about, going low carb or reducing carbohydrates.
Yeah. A story I've shared multiple times on the podcast is, I don't have diabetes. I think anyone would consider me pretty healthy. I wore a CGM, a couple years ago for a couple weeks, and, I was eating what I thought was, heart healthy grain based cereal. It wasn't, it wasn't Fruit Loops. It was, some, whole grain brand cereal. Yeah. And that spiked me more than anything.
Yeah. Oatmeal yeah. spikes me a lot. I grew up on oatmeal, fruit, like even like an orange or something like that. But if you mix the meal with protein and fiber, that has a significant attenuation, in the glycemic spike. I think, and also fat too. So protein, fat, and fiber is pretty much all you need. and then you can adjust carbohydrates accordingly, and I think this is more important for people as we age, as we become increasingly more, insulin resistant as a consequence of age, which I think is to some extent true. But for the high school kid, for the college kid, for the athletic younger people, they can probably do well on a high carbohydrate diet and not see any overt consequences. Although I don't know, we do have an obesity crisis with with kids. So there's some insulin resistance and metabolic dysfunction going on there that we need to address. And I think addressing it with the guidelines would be the way to do it. I think the low hanging fruit is really like sugar sweetened beverages and just hyper processed food, just eliminating that, especially. I mean, that's the first thing that we need to target, not put everybody on a ketogenic diet.
And for you, like, where do you draw that line between hyper processed and less processed? Because, like, for example, if I go back to the American Diabetes Association, they've got a voluminous website filled with snack and meal recommendations. One of them that I have, you know, top of mind is there's one that's, you know, multi-grain Cheerios and chocolate chips. Mm-hmm. Like, what, like, where does that come from? And is that hyper-processed? Is that mildly processed food? How do you think about that?
Well, I think in terms of like the 80-20 rule, so single ingredient, whole food diet, right? So it could be that simple, right? Whatever you're eating should just be like a single ingredient. And that would, if we did that, like 80% of our diet was whole food, single ingredient, you know, things, then that would probably solve the problem. But, you know, I eat processed food sometimes too. And, you know, we went out for Mexican food the other day. Maybe I had some like tacos and things like that. And would be totally fine. But I think the large majority of people are getting 80% of their calories, not 20%, 80% of their calories off processed food, which includes anything made, you know, any kind of bread, any kind of chip, any kind of cereal is considered processed, where ingestion of the food triggers an absorption of carbohydrates and spike of glucose above and beyond what our bodies are used to experience through millennia of evolution. So in the last 100 years, like we've not changed at all, you know, pretty much from a metabolic perspective, but our food system has changed like significantly. And not everybody has to radically implement dietary changes, but the large majority of people really do. And I don't think they recognize the impact of the processed food as, and I think they would recognize if they simply wore a CGM, which is becoming a really important. We did a study where we use continuous glucose monitor as a behavioral tool. And it was not done for, we coupled it with a low carb diet, which had a profound effect. And the CGM was a little bit within the noise, but we didn't have the statistical significance in the sample size to really get the power that we needed to validate CGM as a behavioral tool. But I think for many people, simply wearing a CGM once every quarter or once or twice a year can be a powerful behavioral tool to allow them to understand what processed food is doing to their system.
And to give people a little bit more of a concrete sense of what low versus high carbohydrate diet means, can you give us just a rough estimate? Like what percentage of calories is the average American getting from carbohydrates? And what would you consider to be roughly a low carb diet?
Yeah, I think the literature may describe low carb as like under 30%, which is still a kind of high carb from the ketogenic world. But according to the guidelines, the standard American diet is anywhere from 60 to 70%. Carbohydrate. And that might be fine, like for some people, depending upon the selection of carbohydrates that they're eating. But I think it is, I think contributes to the obesity and type 2 diabetes problem that we have. And as we age, I think the guidelines should kind of be different as we age, or if we have prediabetes, and especially if we have type 2 diabetes and type 1 diabetes, but the guidelines are just kind of blanketed and just applied to everybody. So, I mean, I think it's safe to say that a high school athlete has a different a different carbohydrate tolerance than like a 50 or 60 year old, but the guidelines are the same, right?
So I have a number of questions related to ketosis, ketogenic diet, and brain and mental health. I want to start out by just sort of asking you broadly, you know, what's going on in that world right now? What do you think is interesting, and what do you think is sort of the most important aspect of how ketosis can help with certain forms of psychiatric illness or just sort of overall brain function?
So there has been an explosion of research on ketogenic diets, and I think it's because there's so many mechanisms that the ketogenic diet works through. Just real briefly, like we study reactive oxygen species. So oxidative stress goes down, a decrease in glycolytic flux, a decrease in insulin. It changes the neurotransmitter balance. So the glutamate to GABA balance, adenosine receptor signaling, NAD. Everybody's talking about NAD supplements. So ketogenic diets profoundly change NAD levels, suppresses inflammation, and also like epigenetic signaling. So that's, I mean, these are like the things that we study. But if we go to like the human clinical trials, in 2010, I remember looking like, are there any studies looking at cancer? And there was like maybe one or two. And now there's, if we look at cancer and like muscle wasting, and I put them under like cancer cachexia, there's like three dozen, I think. So there has been an explosion of research in the evidence-based applications for human clinical trials. And if you go to clinicaltrials.gov, there's about 490 clinical trials if you just type in ketogenic diet. So just to put this in context, about 10, 15 years ago, there was like six, right? So it's going to take a while for this research to hit PubMed. So I think, you know, there are a lot of people are like, remember the ketogenic diet was a fad a few years ago. Now you don't hear anything about it. But I think if you look at PubMed and you look at clinicaltrials.gov, the research is exponentially increasing.
Yeah. So just in terms of the volume that's out there, unpublished and unfinished, over the next few years, there's going to be a lot of new information.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And type 2 diabetes, like you mentioned, about a dozen clinical trials, even for things like migraine, of course, inborn errors of metabolism. There's that. Parkinson's, Alzheimer's disease, quite a few clinical trials. And then what you alluded to, the emerging applications of the ketogenic diet are very interesting, especially in metabolic psychiatry. The psychiatric diseases include bipolar, schizophrenia, depression, anxiety. The psychiatric disease that kills more people than anyone is anorexia. So there's actually clinical trials on it. Yeah, it kills more people than anyone. So there's some very compelling case reports on using ketogenic diets for anorexia and also coupling it with ketamine. So the synergy between ketogenic diet and ketamine seems to be very efficacious for managing anorexia. And that's a really interesting area of research. So
that's
25 clinical trials.
I think. I mean, the last thing you mentioned is kind of interesting given, you know, there's a brand new paper out where they've developed a new drug that's sort of a dual GLP-1 NMDA receptor antagonist drug, which is what ketamine is. So that's kind of interesting.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah. Ketamine works through NMDA, yeah, agonist, right?
So antagonist.
Oh, that's what I meant, antagonist. Like, okay, yep. Interesting.
I haven't actually read that paper yet, but it looks really interesting. Everyone is chirping about it right now.
That's really interesting. So for schizophrenia, like I teach those lectures in neuroform, there's like the NMDA receptor hypofunction hypothesis, you know, for schizophrenia. And then for the NMDA receptor, there's like many different ways to modulate it. There's like the glycine co-agonist that you need, you know, and then I did a lot of electrophysiology and patch clamping as a PhD student. And we would always use like high magnesium, low calcium to block like synaptic activity and manipulating magnesium and other different blockers of the NMDA. So that's a really interesting area of research, I think.
One thing I want to get you talking about a little bit is, okay, so there's all these interesting results and hints at least that lots of different brain functions related to all sorts of different neuropsychiatric diseases seem to be modified by ketogenic diets or being in ketosis. I want to get people thinking about like why that is, why we would, you know, maybe see such a diversity here. And one of the things that you mentioned is affected by ketosis is the excitatory inhibitory balance of the brain, the ratio of GABA to glutamate. Can you talk a little bit more about what that is and why that's sort of a central thing to brain function?
Yeah, sure. Well, in regards to epilepsy, we know that many, I guess you could even extend it to all different neurodegenerative diseases and neurological diseases are in some way pathophysiologically linked to glutamate hyperexcitability. So Alzheimer's disease, you have a seizure, glutamate goes through the roof. Bipolar, schizophrenia, there's like a dysregulation of neurotransmitter balance with glutamate's the most abundant neurotransmitter. in the system, and glutamate is converted to GABA via an enzyme, glutamic acid decarboxylase. And then there's different enzymes that make that GAD65 and 67. We looked at these proteins and see that they are elevated. They're elevated in the context of a ketogenic diet, and then GAD65 and 67 are also elevated in the context of supplemental ketones. So being in a state of ketosis increases the conversion of glutamate to GABA. And many anti-seizure drugs by gabatrin work through a GABAergic mechanism. So, and I think that has to do in many ways just by impacting metabolic control in the brain, by restoring normal metabolic control is impacting the Krebs cycle and various intermediates and upstream metabolites like alpha-ketoglutarate, and influencing the conversion of glutamate to GABA. So you have brain energy metabolism is significantly restored and in balance just through the ketones. So that's one. And by virtue of restoring energetic flux in the brain, that's restoring neurotransmitter systems. So like many of the enzymes are made in the mitochondria, like monoamine oxidase, for example, is a mitochondrial enzyme. So by improving and enhancing mitochondrial function and various intermediates, we're improving replenishing neurotransmitter systems and also restoring some of the enzymatic pathways associated with neurotransmitter homeostasis. So that's a key thing, but also oxidative stress. So my early experiments were taking hippocampal slices and exposing them to graded levels of oxygen and then hitting them with different toxins and things like that. And then that ultimately led to studies with ketones showing that ketones could preserve mitochondrial function at the same time knocking down reactive oxygen species. So superoxide dismutase, catalase, glutathione, all these things tend to be increased and in balance. And then we looked at adenosine A1 receptor signaling. So that's another thing. When we did metabolomics in the blood and in the brain, we saw adenosine goes way up, and that we didn't really expect that. But that was an interesting observation. So it sent us down the rabbit hole of looking at adenosine receptor signaling, which is pretty complex, and maybe I won't get into it. But I'll say that adenosine is a very powerful vasodilator. So I think some of the increase in brain blood flow associated with fasting and acute ketosis is due in part to an elevation of adenosine causing a vasodilation effect. And that increase in brain blood flow is impacting brain energy metabolism. So a lot of people don't know that, but it's like, I think that's important to acknowledge. And there's other theories that people are putting out there about NAD levels, which are significantly impacted by like fasting and ketogenic diets.
In which direction?
An elevation of available NAD in the context of ketosis. So I think that comes into play. And then of course I'll have to add we did a study, it was published in Nature Medicine. I formulated the diet, but it was looking at the NLRP3 inflammasome. And there was some early work done at Yale showing that fasting suppresses the NLRP3 inflammasome and then IL-1 beta. And then the same lab reproduced the study using supplemental ketosis. So beta hydroxybutyrate was the molecule that was responsible for suppressing this inflammasome that when it assembles and becomes activated, stimulates IL-1 beta. And then beta hydroxybutyrate suppresses that. Mm-hmm. So I think neurological diseases like bipolar, schizophrenia, especially depression, are associated with neuroinflammation. And I think ketones play a role in suppressing that.
Mm-hmm. So if BHB is one of the ketones that can be sufficient to trigger some of these effects, does that say that So if someone's not on a ketogenic diet, they're not in a strong state of ketosis, they're eating, let's just say, moderate carb intake. If you supplement with BHB, can that reproduce some of the effects of being in full-blown ketosis?
Some of the effects, yeah. I think my opinion is that therapeutic ketosis is much more beneficial in the context of some kind of energy deficit or neurological dysregulation. It tends to work really well. However, we've done studies on, you know, normal healthy animals, and we see like beneficial effects, you know, on some of these biomarkers. So I think the more metabolically dysfunctional and neurologically dysregulated, the more opportunity to use ketogenic therapies as, you know, a therapy. Mm-hmm. And that could be, there's many different ways to implement many different types of ketogenic diets, ketogenic fats, and exogenous ketones. So there's different ways to go about doing that.
I'm also interested in whether or not ketosis can perform sort of sustained, can lead to sustained resetting of cells. So for example, is there any evidence out there, any work being done that shows that if someone goes into ketosis for, say, a number of weeks, that there are metabolic changes in cells that actually sustain themselves even when they come out of ketosis and start eating a different type of diet?
Well, to answer that question, the more we're in ketosis, the better we have an enhanced ability to transport and utilize ketones as an energy source. Mm-hmm. So I would say yes, but under that sort of context that, and other people were of the opinion too. And I remember reaching out to the late Dr. Richard Veach, because I was under the opinion that you needed to adapt to a ketogenic diet to start feeling any benefits over time. Mm-hmm. And I remember talking with him early on, because he had developed the ketone monoester. And talking with him and saying, no, he was very adamant that your body always had the ability, your brain always had the ability to use ketones as an energy source, and you could acutely lower it. And in 5 to 10 minutes, as your ketones elevate, then your brain has that fuel and could be optimized. And then that he also did some seminal work to show that the hydraulic efficiency of the heart, for example, was significantly increased, you know, by burning beta-hydroxybutyrate as a fuel. That would be a difficult experiment to reproduce in the brain because you have a working heart preparation. But he was more or less under the impression that the same metabolic enhancement would happen in the brain too. So your question is like, you know, if you sustain that chronically, will that lead to favorable changes in like the neurons in the brain? I think it would, but not sure that has been sufficiently answered experimentally.
I see. Going to cancer. So you mentioned there's some interesting work being done with respect to ketosis and cancer. What's going on there? And maybe as a starting point, can you just give people a little primer on cancer cell metabolism? Are cancer cells primarily using glucose? Does their metabolism work in a different way from non-cancer cells? And then how does ketosis tie into that?
Yeah, I think maybe I'd start with like, you know, one of the imaging technologies that is important for identifying the location and aggressiveness of tumors would be the FDG PET scan. So we have been using that imaging technology for decades to identify cancer, but not using that information to target the tumors. So the more aggressive and metastatic and invasive the cancer, the hotter it is on a fluorodeoxyglucose PET scan. So when you're imaging a tumor and it's much, much higher intensity on a PET scan, that's basically showing glucose uptake in the tumor. And that's what we call essentially the Warburg effect or the Warburg phenotype for the cancer metabolism. So the Warburg effect is, you know, I guess it could be described as, I don't want to get too technical, but impaired mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation with compensatory fermentation. So Warburg, and many people debate this in some ways. We all agree that the Warburg effect happens, but there's a debate on sort of the reason why it happens. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle, to be honest. But the Warburg effect endows cancer cells and the tumor to basically hijack various intermediates and direct them to the expanding biomass of the tumor. So the Warburg effect is essentially using fermentable fuels like glutamine, like glucose and glutamine as an energy source, but also as biosynthetic precursors for to develop membrane, to develop, you know, components of the cell as the cell expands. And the fermentation pathway also allows the tumor to grow in a low oxygen environment, a very low oxygen environment. And if you were to like, if like for a glioblastoma, for example, a very aggressive tumor, if you were to just like go in there and take a sample of the tumor, what you would see is that all the mitochondria are aberrant in some way. So the mitochondrial structure and the function is significantly changed in cancer cells that present with this Warburg phenomenon. So what that means from a high level, you know, from a translatable level, is that we can target the Warburg effect by decreasing glucose availability, decreasing circulating insulin, which is a growth factor, activates, you know, mTOR pathway and you know, the PI3 kinase pathway is something that has been various drugs being developed for that. And when the tumor is metabolizing these fermentable fuels, it's dumping lactic acid into the microenvironment, and that acidification drives the invasiveness and the growth of the tumor. So limiting glucose availability and fermentable fuels is like the first thing you could do to take your foot off the gas pedal, mm-hmm. right? And ketogenic diets do a number of things. They lower glucose availability, they lower insulin, they lower inflammation, they reduce reactive oxygen species signaling, they decrease inflammatory drivers of the tumor, and they make the tumor more vulnerable to standard of care therapies. That includes chemotherapy, radiation, more recently, immune-based therapies. So even 2 weeks of a ketogenic diet augments the adaptive immune system and can enhance the ability of certain drugs like checkpoint inhibitors, PD-1 inhibitors in particular, and augment their responsiveness. So there was a study published, I believe, Nature Medicine or Communications, where they compared a vegan diet, which increased the innate immunity, and a ketogenic diet, which greatly augmented the adaptive immunity. And the adaptive immunity is kind of interesting because that has implications for immune therapies, in particular checkpoint inhibitors. So that has actually become a hot area of research in cancer research with ketogenic diets now.
So it seems like there's a dual benefit to being in ketosis with respect to cancer. On the one hand, you're sort of minimizing the fuel the cancer itself can use to keep yep. growing. And on the other hand, it seems to enhance some of these therapies we have that attack the cancer.
Yeah. And you could also add that the ketones and being in ketosis protects the normal healthy cells too. So especially if you're getting like radiation therapy, great work was done by Dr. Adrienne Scheck, where she like did whole brain radiation of animals in ketosis, even like without a tumor, and it like protected their brains. Like, you know, without being in ketosis, like all the animals died. And if they're in a state of ketosis, like they all lived. So there's like radiation protection issues there. That's why, you know, organizations like NASA have some interest in ketogenic therapies, because their ability to protect against radiation environments, extreme environments, the anti-inflammatory effects too, I think are an important component, because chemotherapy and radiation produce profound inflammation at the tumor site and systemically. And if we can protect the body from the collateral damage from the inflammation, that's going to be like an important thing to do. And the ketones have their own anti-cancer effects, I think, through reducing certain glycolytic pathways. They have neuroprotection, anti-inflammatory effects. And, you know, and it can be said that some tumor cells may use ketones maybe not so much as an energy source, but could be incorporated into like lipid biosynthesis. So there are some cells, that some types of cancers that may be much more amenable to ketogenic therapies than other types of cancers. And I think we're very interested in like glioblastoma and cancers that are receptive, but I'm equally interested in cancers that are not, you know, to figure
understanding
out
why.
Yeah.
So it sounds like there's at least some evidence that at least intermittently going into and out of ketosis could have preventative benefits with respect to cancer.
I think so. Yeah, it hasn't been studied, but you could say that any intervention that would like significantly improve metabolic biomarkers, inflammation, mitochondrial health, you could say that with fasting, you could say that with caloric restriction. However, I think we believe that, you know, being in a deep state of ketosis, pushing insulin really low, potentially triggering things like autophagy, mitophagy, that this could potentially, you know, target precancerous cells or cancer stem cells, and could also increase the adaptive immune system or enhance the immune system in a way to make the immune system more vigilant in identifying and neutralizing precancerous cells. So there's been, you know, animal work that suggests that, but I'm not sure of any human. Well, the one human study, the 2-week diet intervention showing, you know, big changes in immune markers of adaptive immunity. That was just a pilot study, but yeah, we're hoping to expand on that, working with Moffitt Cancer Center to sort of expand upon that with checkpoint inhibitors.
Mm-hmm. It's no secret that many, many people are over consuming sugar in general. Obviously that ties into the cancer stuff we were just talking about, that ties into insulin resistance, it ties into just general health. You definitely don't want to be consuming too much sugar, but sugar, added sugars are in all sorts of things. What is your general view on sugar substitutes? Everything from, you know, so-called non-caloric sweeteners, things like Splenda, to other sugar alternatives. Are they actually better? Are we substituting, you know, one bad thing for a different type of bad thing? Are there any good, truly healthy sugar substitutes?
Yeah, glad you asked that. I'm of the opinion that artificial sweeteners like saccharin, aspartame, sucralose are a suitable alternative to sugar in different foods. I don't think they're ideal, but I don't think it's like the lesser of two evils, right? So I don't think there's any, you know, beneficial effects. But I think the data supporting that they are they're pathological or, you know, bad in some way, I just don't think the data is there, especially in regards to cancer. I think there was a lot of discussion about aspartame and cancer, and I did a deep dive. Actually, we did like a little social post with the Moffitt Cancer Center CEO. And I think, I know aspartame, I believe, was designated potential cause of cancer, but so are other things, like other food things that we eat. So I'm not too concerned with artificial sweeteners, but I think we should limit them because I do think they have an impact on our brain's desire for hyperpalatable foods. And I think they could stimulate brain pathways, dopaminergic pathways, maybe to seek sweeter foods. So I think the jury's still out. The effects on the microbiome, I think, are still under investigation. And I think it's safe to say that they're not completely benign in regards to changing the microbiome. So they can change a microbiome, but it's not entirely clear whether that could be pathological or maybe even beneficial. Mm-hmm. I am a big fan of allulose. So allulose is an epimer of fructose. It uses the glucose 5 transporter, and there are some types of cancer cells that overexpress the GLUT5 transporter. And we're doing some experiments in our lab now to looking at it in the absence and presence of allulose and getting some interesting data to suggest that allulose could be potentially used in a ketogenic diet formulation as a sugar a natural sugar-based alternative. So it's a rare sugar. It's not artificial. It's found in things like figs and some fruits and maybe kiwi. So allulose consumed at 20 grams in a single bolus is probably like your tolerability limit. So if you want to incorporate allulose, I would suggest, you know, start with like 5 grams and work up from there.
What do you mean by tolerability?
So the ability to absorb allulose in the gut is contingent upon the presence of the GLUT5 transporter. So if you're not sufficiently absorbing it all, it could cause an osmotic shift, give you diarrhea. Maybe it's fermentable, gives some people some gas. But I think of all the different sweeteners out there, artificial and natural, I think allulose is the most promising for a number of reasons that, it is a natural sugar. It's kind of self-limiting in that you can't like, it's not hyper palatable. So it has a nice mild sweet taste, but it's not like super hyper sweet, like sucralose. It's transported through the GLUT5 transporter because it's an epimer of fructose, which uses the GLUT5, and it lowers blood glucose, which is very interesting. So I wear a CGM and I consume allulose and my glucose actually goes down. It has very little, if any, insulin response, which is another benefit. And I think a lot of people are very interested in allulose because it triggers the release of GLP-1. So there's a Nature Communications paper showing that an equivalent of the human equivalent would be like me consuming, I think, 30 or 40 grams, but there was a 500% increase in the release of GLP-1. So I think, and people do report it has a appetite suppressing effect. So you have this rare sugar that's mildly sweet, lowers blood glucose, has virtually no insulin response, and is a GLP-1 mimetic, almost like a natural Ozempic. So there are reasons why. I'll have to disclose that I am a research advisor for the company RX Sugar, and they make allulose products. I was slow to come on board, but the thing that got me on board was the peer-reviewed literature. I was like, I want to study this. So we're studying it from the context of from the cancer research right now, because I think it could be, we have a potential natural sugar that could further enhance ketogenic therapies, make them more palatable and make them more efficacious, especially in cancers that overexpress the GLUT5 transporter.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. How do you manage your own diet, your own life? Are you in a perpetual state of ketosis? Are you going in and out of it intermittently? How do you manage your own metabolic states week to week?
Yeah, I do a low carb diet that's kind of puts me in ketosis, I think a mild state, like, you know.
How low is low carb?
Well, today I've had no carbs, like almost 2:30, right? I had just some salmon and eggs for breakfast maybe 8 hours ago. So I'm in a state of ketosis now, maybe like 2 millimolar. I do consume, like I have ketogenic exogenous ketones that I'll sip throughout the day, especially if I have a long day of teaching or something like that. But typically I eat about 3 meals a day. Each meal is pretty low in carbohydrates, and I tend to get more of my carbohydrates in the form of vegetables and fruits towards the end of the day. The carbohydrates that I consume are salads, broccoli, avocados, blueberries, some dark chocolate, maybe an apple here and there. So usually about 70, 80 grams of carbs. This works great for me. I feel like it optimizes my microbiome. If I don't have that fiber in, I just feel that my microbiome and my gut mobility, motility is not as optimal as it would be otherwise. So there's a big discussion with fiber. I do think fiber is beneficial. I take, as I mentioned, psyllium husk fiber at nighttime before bed. I'm not overly obsessive about tracking, but I've tracked in the past, and my diet is so routine that I pretty much know, give or take, 5% of the macros. So I'm getting about 200 grams of protein a day, maybe 220 to some days, 250 grams of fat per day, and maybe 50 to 80 grams of carbs a day, high fiber carbs.
Mm-hmm. So you're getting comparable levels of protein and fat and much, much lower carb intake.
Yeah, for sure. Yep. And carbs may go up on weekends if, you know, we're out and about and doing stuff and eating out. But generally speaking, yeah, it's pretty much low carbs. There'll be some days where I'm working really long hours in the lab or at the office and I won't have any carbs at all. I'll just come home at night and maybe have like almost a zero carb day. But on average, it's pretty consistent, like 50 to 80 grams a day.
Is there any work that's been done with respect to ketogenic diets and headache or migraines?
Yeah. Dr. Elena Gross in Europe, she was a migraine sufferer and kind of developed a ketogenic product that is actually beneficial for migraines. And we co-authored a review together basically showing that migraines, kind of proposing this hypothesis that migraines are like a sign of an energetic crisis in the brain and also inflammation. And a lot of people respond positively to ketogenic therapies for migraine. I'll say that some people do get migraines from starting a ketogenic diet, but I think that's more or less when they part of the transition phase, maybe mm-hmm. the electrolytes are off or things like that. And I get quite a few emails from people who try exogenous ketones and they tell me it relieves their migraines when nothing else helped. So I think if there are people out there with migraines, going into ketosis could be really beneficial.
Interesting. What are, you know, one or two of the things that you're working on in the lab today that you think are particularly interesting that we'll have results for in, say, the next year or so? What's on the horizon for you?
Yeah, I would say, I'm very interested in, and this is broadly speaking of, I think there's a lot of potential for innovation of the diet composition. So, you know, we've kind of just default to like the standard ketogenic diet just with macronutrient ratios. And I think evidence is coming out that a higher protein ketogenic diet, not like the 10 to 12%, but upwards of 20%, can be more favorable in regards, like we call it a modified supplemented ketogenic diet. We call it modified because it's got higher protein, and we call it supplemented because we supplement medium chain triglyceride fats as a significant percentage of the fat component of the diet, mm-hmm. but can also further enhance the ketogenic potential of the diet by incorporating exogenous ketones. And ketone esters can be beneficial, but ketone electrolyte salts are probably much better for the everyday person. So, and ketone esters and things like 1,3-butanediol need to be metabolized by the liver. It does create a beta hydroxybutyrate aldehyde and some things that could be potentially toxic. So I think they're good in like the acute setting, maybe like military operations. But I think, you know, a ketogenic diet that's engineered that has specific fatty acid profile with omega-3s, MCTs, higher protein, and also prebiotic fiber and a different types of fiber, maybe some resistant starch. And I'm just speaking very broadly here, is like a step function above the ketogenic diets that are used now in like epilepsy clinics. And I think there's a lot of potential for innovation there. So we're working and designing these diets more or less for like different inborn errors of metabolism, but also for use in cancer studies. So I think, and the higher protein component is also going to be important, but not really high protein, especially in cancer, because you could be driving some processes that could fuel cancer. So there's like a fine line there in optimizing that protein content. So on the cancer front, yeah, diet optimization, diet engineering, but also I would say, just thinking broadly, medical education is a big thing, what we're focusing on. And that's why, you know, I co-host the Metabolic Health Summit and Metabolic Health Initiative. So a big part of what we're doing, even from a lab perspective, is getting, you know, top tier medical students and PhD students and postdocs to actually work with us in the lab so they can go on and into their academic careers and clinical careers and be advocates for dietary approaches and metabolic health optimization. And that could be not necessarily ketogenic diet, but just being aware of the metabolic biomarkers and the power of diet, the power of exercise, the power of tracking glycemia with a CGM. Like there's so many components to this that are just not yet recognized by the mainstream medical community.
All right. Well, we've covered a lot. Thanks so much for your time. Always glad to talk to you. For those listening, I've talked to Dominic once before on the podcast. We covered some different topics in that one. So if you want to learn more, check that one out. Any final thoughts you want to leave people with? Anything you want to reiterate that we went over?
No, I think, well, if you want to take a deeper dive on what we talked about, my website is ketonutrition.org. And then the Metabolic Health Summit is a summit that we co-host, and it was in Clearwater, Florida a few months ago. We have a lot of top tier speakers, and many of those speakers are on the Metabolic Link podcast, where we take a deep dive into many different topics that we covered here. So yeah. So for your listeners that want more information, just check out those sites.